Welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we're continuing our conversation about the fallout from the Baltimore Justice Department report on policing and also discussing a little bit about how that community is moving forward. Later in the show, we'll be talking about the Port Covington project and some of the issues around gentrification as well. But before we can move on, another day, another entry into the annals of entirely absurd police murders. Donnell Thompson was murdered by police in Compton because they thought he was someone else. Thompson was 27, but had the IQ of a much younger man. He was so quiet and gentle, his nickname was Little Bo Peep. The saga that led to his death began with a carjacking, allegedly at gunpoint, in Compton. A man stole a car and then ended up running from the police. That man was apprehended, but they weren't entirely sure he was the suspect. So another deputy sees Donnell sleeping on the ground, this is somewhere else now, and thinks he matches the quote-unquote description. The description, however, was of a black male, 20s or 30s, wearing pants or shorts, in a shirt or a sports jersey. So essentially, anyone. Once it was radioed in that the suspect had potentially been found, the L.A. County Sheriff sent an armored car, yes, an actual armored car with a turret and everything, to check it out. Now, this armored car, a military-style vehicle also used in many war zones, rolls up on the yard where Donnell is sleeping. Now, according to the police, what happened next is that Donnell ignored all their commands, refused to move when hit by foam bullets, and ignored a flashbang grenade. Then all of a sudden, he gets up and charges at the officers in this armored car, really a tank, and then the cop in a shirt and a turret shoots him with an M4 assault rifle and kills him. So there's several issues here. One, the story itself seems somewhat unbelievable, and until more facts come out, shouldn't be taken as gospel. In particular, because for 2 weeks, the LA sheriffs actually denied Donnell Thompson was innocent and tried to claim that he was a second suspect in the carjacking. And on top of that fact, in the past 2 weeks, LA County sheriffs have killed an unarmed homeless man who was running away from them and then killed an unarmed graffiti artist who was hiding in a shower, also after running away from them. Secondly, why would they shoot him when they were in essentially a tank? I mean, if he charged at them, even with some sort of handgun, the police were totally insulated, particularly since they had no idea if this was A, who they were looking for, and B, not even sure the guy was armed. It's very unclear why they would then shoot him with an assault rifle. Third, why are they in a tank? I mean, first and foremost, why would someone who just stole a car and ran from the police just be randomly sleeping on a lawn? Wouldn't it have made more sense to just go up and try to find out what was going on, talk to the guy, whatever? Why are the police just rolling around in tanks shooting at people when they have no real idea what's going on? The fact that a description that could literally fit tens of thousands of people at any given moment could end up in a cop with an assault rifle shooting a guy from the turret of a tank is an example of everything that's wrong with policing in America. A judge in Philadelphia on August 9th overturned the convictions of 158 people because of their connection to corrupt cops. Yes, that's right. 158 convictions. If you thought that sounded bad, this actually brings the total number of convictions vacated in relationship to these same corrupt cops up to 560, with at least 40 more to come. All of this is related to the federal investigation of seven police officers who were part of a so-called elite narcotics unit that was accused of planting evidence, doctoring evidence, and beating suspects. Now, six of these officers were acquitted, while a seventh who testified against them was sentenced to 3.5 years in prison. Five of the officers have actually gotten their jobs back. However, the district attorney in Philadelphia, along with the public defender's office in the same city, appears to believe that they were essentially guilty and are now vacating hundreds of cases which they believe can no longer actually hold up in court. So despite the fact that all of the officers basically got off for being super corrupt, the actual evidence in many of the cases they were responsible for apparently are actually tainted by corruption. That is, despite the niceties that these people were able to pull out in a court that got them off, this team of corrupt cops basically were corrupt. And it makes you wonder how many other people around the country are being in prison due to police impropriety. We keep acting like it's a few bad apples, despite the fact that we have Justice Department reports out the wazoo now telling us whole departments in many major metropolitan areas are tainted by racism and brutality. And despite having ample news stories saying the same, somehow this still isn't the common sense in every police shooting. We know policing in America is racist, that it's brutal, that it's in fact terroristic, and more concerned with control than crime. So how many more stories like this until it becomes common sense? Donald Trump is in fourth place among black voters. That's right. He's behind Jill Stein and Gary Johnson, not just Hillary Clinton, which has to be somewhat embarrassing to him, given that he's been saying that he's very popular amongst the blacks, as he would say. What seems really relevant about this story isn't so much that Trump isn't polling that well among black people. That, quite frankly, isn't terribly surprising. What seems more interesting is that there aren't more stories in the mainstream media that reflect the fact that among black people and millennials, Trump is in fourth place. The media continues to make it about a horse race between two people with the occasional odd story about Jill Stein or Gary Johnson. But why not focus on how among younger people, and clearly now among black people, the race isn't so much between Democrats and Republicans, but between Democrats and the so-called quote-unquote third parties. That a growing section of the population prefers to debate the mainstream versus new approaches to governing the country. Perhaps when it's couched in that way, it would actually make more people look critically at other parties and candidates for options in the election. But rather than look for thoughtful stories out of the mass of election polling and other information, we're treated to the same old circus of charges and countercharges, scandals and outrage, and an end result that leaves the corporate dominance in D.C. unchanged. And those were today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And we are joined to continue our conversation by phone with Tariq Toure, who's a native Baltimorean, a Muslim essayist, a poet, an educator, humanitarian, and public speaker. And Tariq, thank you so much for jumping on.
No problem, man. Thank you all for having me.
No, absolutely. And so we've been talking the past couple days a little bit about the Baltimore Justice Department report that came out. We spoke to Dr. Lawrence Brown a little bit about it yesterday, and the first question we asked him was, you know, what surprised you or didn't surprise you in the report? So I wanted to start there. I mean, was anything new or shocking, or was it more or less just a confirmation of what we knew?
I think it was a confirmation of what we knew all along. You know, one of the first things about even reading it and then reading some of the analysis of it is that, you know, you go through these things as a child, you go through these abuses firsthand, and then you also are witness to these state-sanctioned abuses, and you really have no voice in the community that validates these occurrences. And for the most part, you're told if you behave a certain way, then these offenses won't happen to you. And what I think that the Department of Justice report does, it doesn't, you know, it really doesn't validate people who are violated because you already know you had these experiences firsthand. Mm-hmm. But what it does is it legitimizes, you know, what you may be perceiving in your own, you know, sanity. So it's like, you know, I know I'm not crazy.
Right.
You know,
right.
And it shows that it's something that's happening widespread. And it also shows that, you know, you're really not alone. And as these reports come out from across the country, it's going to start, you know, ringing out a broader narrative of the United States being really a police state. And it'll show more of the uglinesses of what's happening in this era and what's continued to happen to the world.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I think that's certainly true. And I mean, I wonder, just touching on that, I think that's an interesting point. I mean, you know, how important do you think the international context is for people who are working on the ground as activists and organizers? I mean, I think we see, you know, we're getting stymied so often at the local level looking for, you know, quote unquote reform. I mean, how important is it that we try to push this narrative internationally?
I think it's important. One of the things that H. Rod Brown, well, Ma'am Jamil, I mean, formerly H. Rod Brown, said was that, you know, African-Americans and black and brown people here in America are representative of being in the brain of America being this imperial force for so many centuries now. And it's important to other people in the world who are suffering the same or if not more abuses by the government and the state that you know, we have similar struggles, we have parallel struggles, and us echoing each other helps in the fight to stop these things as well. Us, you know, knowing that, in places in Africa, the same things going on. In places in South America, they're the same abuses happening. And it forges solidarity among people. And when you become one, you can start to devise ideas and come up with plans to stop these issues.
Mm-hmm. And you know, one other sort of issue that in the wake of the cops and the Freddie Gray, not really the Freddie Gray trial, the trial of the cops who murdered Freddie Gray, that after they were all the charges were dropped, that I think a lot of people in the media were asking, and I think maybe for their own self-interested reasons, was, well, okay, how come people aren't rising up inside of Baltimore? And I wanted to get your thoughts on that. I mean, is it just a case of, you know, people fatigue, we've tried everything and nothing has happened? Or is it really in some ways that a lot of organizers on the ground in Baltimore have now just sort of shifted their work in ways that perhaps is less visible?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the latter is perfect. It's a perfect example. You know, if you look at the history of uprisings, period, from the conception of America and, you know, really just the first genocide here, there was never a day after day after day uprising. You know, that's just, you know, so to think that would occur now in this time would be, you know, negating history. And I think that in Baltimore, people are really just trying to do their day-to-day work in organizing, their day-to-day work in whatever they do in activism, and just trying to live and survive. And that doesn't really translate to a burning CVS. It doesn't really translate to standoffs with the police. It doesn't translate to that. You have a lot of organizations and groups and individuals who have, started strategizing more and started digging in on the ground level more. You have others who have decided to, you know, become a voice for the things that are happening on the ground. And a lot of times, those maneuvers, whether it's in education, healthcare, whether it's in the arts, those maneuvers don't really get big publicity unless something's on fire. So maybe, I don't know, you know, if if something goes on fire again, then people would be apt to come back and say, hey, you know, this children's center has been running for however many days and involved with, you know, 150 youth, and it may get pressed, but not the same as a CVS burning.
Mm-hmm. And you know, one of the things that this was an inaccurate impression in the first place, but I was hoping you could reflect on, you know, I was there for about 4 days right after the uprising. And the thing that shocked, not shocked me, but just still to this day stands out the most to me was just like, it was such a high degree of unity inside mm-hmm. of the Black community in Baltimore. People kept saying, Baltimore's back, Baltimore's back. The I Bleed Baltimore shirts were everywhere. And it was, I mean, I really don't think I've ever seen anything before or since in terms of that level of unity. I mean, could you speak to maybe in wake of the uprising, sort of the sense of community mm-hmm. inside of Baltimore?
Well, I think one of the best tricks and best strategies of oppression is having the oppressed have a certain distrust of each other. And I can't say it's all kumbaya. You know, I'd be lying if I said it was all kumbaya now. But it is something like, you know, me, myself, and others are reflecting on how quick after this plight of people who are dispossessed was sensationalized, how quick people who were in the fight, you know, to have, you know, folks' humanity recognized, how quickly they became at odds over tactics, over integrity, over whatever their issue could be. And I think that, you know, it may have been the Achilles heel, but, you know, you look at any oppressed people and whatever caste system along, you know, within that structure of oppressed people, you're going to find that groups continue to be at odds, people continue to be at odds because of personalities, because of egos, because of economic gain, because of status, that they become a bit polarized. What I can say about Baltimore is that even there may be a certain level of polarization now, after the dust has settled, people are still doing amazing work. You know, the work hasn't really, the quality hasn't dropped in as far as people investing in a better Baltimore. But I believe that once we begin to say, hey, we need to go back to that solidarity that we had, you'll see Baltimore again take another skyrocket and move forward.
We're going to take a break, but we will be back with more from Tariq Ture out of Baltimore. And we're going to talk about a lot more related to everything that we've been discussing the past couple days. You're listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. And as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we're talking about what's next for Baltimore, the role athletes play in the movement for Black Lives, and the rise of a new crop of activists. And we are joined by phone to continue our conversation with Tariq Ture, a native Baltimorean, a Muslim essayist, poet, educator, humanitarian, and public speaker. And I'll just keep it moving. And I wanted to pick up on something you said towards the end there that I thought was very interesting, the issue of divisions, because, you know, the other thing that struck me, too, and I agree with you, was it appears to me that there's also some element of counterinsurgency there as well. I mean, I actually happen to be in a space with several major foundations, and they were the first thing they were talking about is how we got to get all this money to all these people in Baltimore to do this, that, and the third. And certainly they weren't necessarily the type of people who've been in the greatest accord with the community. So, I mean, it seems like that's also a factor for people to consider in terms of, like, quote unquote, what's happening with the movement or in these cities like Baltimore and Ferguson, is it's not just an issue of the people who are, you know, sincere, but also having to combat those who aren't.
Yeah. I think in a fight to, well, number one, just understanding that there's a caste system, there's a class system, even among people who are marginalized, you know. So, I mean, even myself, I come from West Baltimore, but I've had the opportunity and the privilege to obtain an education or be considered a working class person. However, you know, we have to, and there's a people who are above me socioeconomically and education-wise, and there are people who fall below myself as far as, you know, getting a formal education. And we all have our particular strengths. And I think when we don't recognize that there is that caste and class system, then when you have foundations coming in and pouring in money, and people can be looked over because they may not even recognize their own privilege and where they stand at on the totem pole. And, you know, that just so the counterinsurgency, that comes into light, you know, when grants start getting passed out and you got, you know, several different people going for the same grant and all of those, you know, I liken it to, you know, somebody who's just literally dying of thirst, you know, the people who are the most dispossessed. And you have multiple activists, organizers, community people, politicians, you know, they're saying, you know what, I have Dasani, and another person saying I have Aquafina, another person who says they're in Deer Park. And while they're all arguing about who has the best water, the people who are dying of thirst are without water. And then you have other people who actually, you know, they forget it. I'm just going to get the water hose out of my house because it's the best form, and they're giving them water. And instead of focusing on giving them water, they're talking about how much those people over there fussing about the water, how much their water, instead of, you know, the main focus is just giving out water, you know. Right. So that's kind of how I've seen things, and it's how I've been forced to see things. I try to, you know, keep a very level playing field with everybody. And because I'm just about unity now, and I'm seeing, you know, within 5 years of 4 to 5 years of what happened with Trayvon Martin, which was kind of like the big spark plug, we have all the capabilities possible of digging out of this hole. But from my side, we just really have to unify. Mm-hmm. We got to see what everybody's good at. We got to shake hands, kiss cheeks. I don't know what to do.
No, I hear you.
Yeah. So every time I've had a chance to speak on any airwave, that's the move. Mm-hmm. And that's the wave that I'm on, is we have to have some type of solidarity.
Mm-hmm. No, and absolutely. And then speaking of unity, shout out to D. Watkins, who hooked us up and made this interview possible. Got a new edition of the B-side out in paperback for folks to check out. But switching gears a little bit, I wanted to. So one of the controversies that you, I don't know if it's a controversy, but that some people didn't like, is when you were putting out the call for LeBron to sit out until there is justice for Tamir Rice. And I wonder now how you're feeling about the issue of athletes' involvement after another Baltimore guy, Carmelo Anthony. He came out with the statement, and the sisters in the WNBA have been going hard and taking fines and things like that. I mean, is this the sort of start of you know, what you were looking to see more from athletes?
I think that's good. I think that ultimately people who have attained that position by way of their body need to understand, if they don't already know, that black and brown folks hold the most cultural power in the world. And definitely African-Americans, who really, you know, we power culture across the world. And, you know, that's evident when you go on YouTube and you see kids in Afghanistan, somewhere in the middle of anywhere in Afghanistan, pop locking on YouTube. And I think when they understand how big sports is to the world, I mean, we're currently watching that happen. You got like almost 26 people from Maryland who are in the Olympics right now getting it. And you see people like Simone Biles, who will become a figurehead for, you know, black excellence and American excellence. And, you know, she's a black kid who's gone through, you know, one of the worst situations that's typical of a lot of other people. Once they understand that, you know, you wield this power, then you almost have to weaponize it, because, you know, we're not a people who have an army. Black folks don't have an army here. We don't have a unified monopoly on a particular industry of trade or anything like that. You know, I don't know any African-Americans who own, you know, big oil rigs. I don't know, you know, oil mines. I don't, you know, coal mines, airplane, you know, companies. There's no black Lockheed Martin. So what do we have power over? And it's our culture and our influence. And it would be foolish for us not to weaponize that, so that there can be some type of consequences when you abuse this certain people. You know, if a Chinese person was here in America and they were abused in a certain way, China would use whatever power it has, you know, which may be economic power, to sanction America for doing what, you know, they did. So that's the big thought of it, is that, look, this is the power we have. It's simple. And I think that the steps that they're taking right now are big, and they're going to be big for the next generation, because you have youth who are watching them take these certain protest acts, and they'll be influenced to do a bit more. You know, they'll be influenced to get more skin in the game. And I think, you know, for myself, and I'm a former college athlete, and I think for myself, what I would like to see is more the organization of it. What happens when when McGinty lets the killers of Tamir Rice off? What happens when clearly the officers who are around when Sandra Bland was murdered in her cell and falsified documents and, you know, were threatened to lose their job? What happens when that, you know, do these games, does this entertainment that Americans, you know, a larger white population, where they derive so much pleasure from watching these black bodies compete, should they still have the pleasure of doing that, when the simple fact is that outside of having a basketball or a football in my hand or a tennis racket,
you would deem me invaluable, you know, no longer valuable. So we have a long road of discussions and strategy to come up with it, but I believe it's a good first step. And, you know, I'm happy if I help with, you know, 1% of that, you know, with my calls to action and me trying to open up a broader discussion. I think we have entered a new era of athletes saying something.
Yeah, well, no, for sure. Well, and there's sort of two questions that come to mind. So, I guess I'll just ask them both. You know, the other thing that popped in is we were just talking is, you know, especially with the WNBA, which doesn't really get a lot of love for a whole range of reasons. I mean, seeing how they really, it's been WNBA players and teams that I think have been the most out there. I mean, does that put some also responsibility on the movement to get out here and support these sisters who are playing basketball in a way that is consistently sort of downplayed? I mean, is it also, I mean, maybe there's no reciprocal piece there, but it does sort of seem like, you know, maybe there is something that people should do.
I mean, I think it's something we have to explore. When folks were asking me about, you know, how should college athletes, you know, move in respect to student organizing, whether there really shouldn't be any separation of thought. You know, the students who, you know, they haven't bartered their bodies, you know, for an education and hopefully a career, but are using their intellectual prowess to organize and fight against these injustices. Well, you know, they can do the heavy lifting as far as, you know, hey, this is how, you know, we may need to be shifting our paradigm in regards to these injustices. You know, and it's on the athlete if he wants to, you know, research more into it for himself. But, you know, it's like, you have a think tank, right? And then you have athletes who, you know, if, you know, what's the sanction going to be? So, you know, it's like if the SGA president, you know, black SGA president at Penn State, if he says, man, I'm not coming to another SGA meeting again, mm-hmm. I'm never coming on campus again.
Right.
Like, oh, okay, no problem. Let's bring another one.
You know? Yeah, right.
It doesn't matter. But when the starting, you know, defensive end who's 6'6", 275 pounds and, you know, averages 3 sacks, 2 sacks a game, you know, 10 tackles and a forced fumble, you know, every now and then, when he says, it's no way I can play with this going on, then we have, you know, we have some movement. And I think they can work together in tandem and, you know, with that. We're not asking athletes, hey, we want you to study, you know, liberation theology while you're studying your playbook and all that. Not whatsoever. Your job, you know, is largely to play ball. But we have to understand that if our advancement as a people was predicated on us going to the NFL, making millions of dollars, becoming billionaires and all that, then you would see us lifting, you know, so much as we climb. And it happens when you still have 44% of African Americans here living in poverty. It shows you that we cannot get into nominal, you know, nominal excellence or nominal gain where it's like, hey, you know, these guys are doing well, so y'all are doing well. No, we're still hurting. And those people who have done well, you know, we collectively, I consider myself in that bunch, we have to do, you know, we have to do more. And the job of, you know, fighting for your people is so that you can press forward using your own influence. So athletes can definitely do that by getting with their, you know, their black student union. You know, it should be, they should have a representative, you know, from black football team, 90% black football team. You should have somebody there. I don't know if it's the quarterback. I don't care who it is.
Right.
They should be there.
Right. Well, and you sort of addressed my second question. So just switching gears real quick in the last few minutes, you know, another conversation that we had this week is about sort of the intersection between Islam in America and the black liberation movement. And as someone who is a, I guess, quote unquote, black Muslim, that term is a little loaded. I mean, I wonder just how you look at a lot of this conversation around Islamophobia. I mean, do you feel that for Muslims who are of African-American descent, you aren't as much in the conversation, and what would you like to maybe add to some of the discussions around that?
I mean, you know, it's almost like you're, you know, you find yourself, you know, it's checked everywhere. You know, so if I go to the airport, you're still that invisible man. Because it's like, whoa, Tariq, whoa, this is a Muslim name, you know. If I'm walking down the street, a black guy in America, which has all, you know, the issues with that. I think within Islamophobia, you know, we just have to understand that, you know, black folks been under surveillance. We've been, you know, getting entrapped. We've been filling the prison walls, doing serious Fed time. Like, they're handing out now, you know, for conspiracies to do certain acts and all that. Like, we've been doing Fed time. And, you know, it's a system that, you know, the whole boogeyman, you know, we were the second boogeyman here. You know, first the Native Americans, then us. So it is important that people who are falling under the eye directly and being racialized as Muslim for the pursuit of emboldening Islamophobia in America, that they forge, you know, solidarity with African Americans and, you know, and black, brown, Latino folks here, people who have been marginalized, so that, again, I'm, you know, back to unity. You know, back to unity, and we can learn from each other and the struggles that we're particularly facing. Imam Suhaib Webb, brother from Oklahoma, you know, Oklahoma white boy, you know, and he became Muslim. And he's one of the most renowned Muslim scholars in America. He has a very good rapport with the youth. You know, when brown Muslims were not saying much about, you know, mandatory minimums, which black Muslims were facing, you know, because we're black, we live in these communities. You know, I got homeboys, you know, five just for two crack vials, you know, just a mandatory minimum. Well, you didn't have, for Muslims who will be racialized as brown, you didn't have the big outcry from them of, you can't just be giving these people mandatory minimums and screwing their lives up forever. Well, if you look at what's happening now with you know, counter-violent extremism, and for people who maybe, you know, they may be going through mental health problems, being entrapped in these terrorist plots, when they really should just be getting seeking help and not having a guy who's undercover in a mosque asking him about blowing up stuff as an FBI agent. You see those guys, they're getting 20 off the bat. Off the bat.
Right. Yeah, for sure. Well, we're going to have to leave it there for the time. But big thanks to Tariq Ture for jumping on to the show. This is By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik. We're going to take a break, but we will be back with more. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By Any Means Necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. Today and yesterday, we talked about the Justice Department's scathing report on the Baltimore police, and now to expand that conversation to other ways in which racism, sexism, and classism are affecting people in Baltimore, we are joined by phone by Charlie Carter, the Maryland State Director of Working Families. Ms. Carter, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I wanted to just sort of really, you know, redirect or expand this conversation by digging down on some of the sort of development issues and what that poses for Baltimore. So, you know, the other big issue that is facing Baltimore, other than the policing issue, is what to do about this major Port Covington development, quote unquote, development project that's seeking a lot of city money. But just to give some context to our listeners, what exactly is going on with this Port Covington project? What is it and what's it proposing?
Certainly. Well, Port Covington right now is vacant industrial land, sort of an industrial wasteland. There are a few outbuildings there. They've tried to develop it for the last 15 or 20 years, but nothing's really succeeded. And now, not far from there, Under Armour is going to build its new headquarters. And the owner of Under Armour, billionaire Kevin Plank, his development company, his personal development company, bought up this land and they want to build, in his words, a Dubai on the Patapsco. That's the river that it sits on. And he thinks it's going to be this glittering city that's filled with the quote unquote creative class. And he wants $500 million from the city of Baltimore and the taxpayers of Baltimore in order to build it. And that's in addition to another $700 million from the state and another $200 million he's asking for the federal government. Much of the, as you might imagine, Baltimore is a very poor city. Anybody who watched the news last April could see the lack of investment in poor neighborhoods and in African-American neighborhoods across the city. There's been no renovation of streets or housing. We have some of the poorest and oldest housing stock in the country. And so, as you might imagine, the community is quite concerned about the city's ability to invest $500 million into what will be an affluent enclave on the waterfront when there are so many other needs that need to that have yet to be met.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, and I have to say, I had not heard that Dubai comment, but that's I don't know, maybe the worst metaphor ever, given that most of the workers in UAE and most of those other countries are, you know, in a semi-slave status. But be that as it may, I wonder, speaking of that, what are some of the parallels you see between sort of what we're learning in the DOJ report and it's happening in these communities around policing to these broader? I mean, it's sort of, I think a lot of people have put it in this context, is economic development kind of the foundation for this? Like the whole policing issue is really more of one dealing with the consequences of there being none, that being development.
I think that what we're seeing is, and what the police report, the DOJ report bears out, is an attitude about many people here in Baltimore and many communities in here in Baltimore that the powers that be would want them neither seen nor heard. They just want these neighborhoods to disappear. If you looked at for the last 20 years where money has been invested, it has been around the waterfront. It's been building up around what they call their eds and meds strategy, which is building up around colleges and universities, building up around the waterfront, and building up around the medical institutions. None of that involves making investments in communities where the majority of Maryland or Baltimore City people live. And the police problems that we see are part, they really grow out of this attitude of two cities. Like, we don't want any trouble out of you. We don't want you to make any noise. We don't want you to complain. Just do as you're told and don't make trouble for the rest of us. And that really came out in the DOJ report when they said that police routinely escalated situations when people did not respond to their verbal commands. They didn't do as they were told. So that's really, I think, at the root of all of this. And we see it consistently because when it comes time to make decisions about how money will get divided, whether it's development or whether it's police policies, who is allowed to walk on the Inner Harbor, for example, they're really aligned. You see a correlation between the lack of investment because those communities are not deemed as important, and those communities aren't seen by the public, by the tourists. And those are the same people who aren't welcome to be part of, you know, harbor, the Inner Harbor, and all the development and all of the happenings that are taking place in these largely white communities that around the harbor.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's interesting to look at the way they want this money. And you mentioned they wanted about $500,000. And in the way, just for our listeners,
half a billion,
500 million. For our listeners, the way they want this money is something called tax increment financing, which is a little complicated, but basically a city takes out a loan and they pay it back with taxes. So oftentimes they raise the taxes in a certain area, blah, 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 blah. And they draw a district. And I was looking at where the taxes are going to be used. So I was looking at a map of the TIF district for this project. And I mean, it's almost all of Baltimore. And it just seemed to me that this is an unbelievable catch-22 for poor communities where the city is on the one hand saying, well, support this because it's going to create jobs, whatever, whatever. But then on the other hand, you know, you didn't have to pay more money in taxes for something that you may never be employed there. You may never be able to shop there. So it's essentially like quote unquote development on the backs of the people who it's supposed to help. I wonder how you reflect on that.
That's exactly what it is this is, I've said it in the past that this is a new kind of Jim Crow where we are, you know, development and building up exclusive, wealthy communities on the backs of poor black and brown people. That the way this TIF is written, the way the law works in Baltimore is that a development, in order to get a TIF, a development has to be adjacent to very poor distressed communities. And that but for the investment of public funds, this development couldn't happen. One of the things we know about Kevin Plank and this development is that last year in 2015, he spent $500 million of his own money to buy up property in Baltimore and elsewhere. We're questioning why you would, if you have the means to make $500 million in investment out of your pocket, why you would need to come to the city of Baltimore, a city that could not afford to continue after school funding and its latest budget, a city that so much is constantly struggles to just to have provide basic services. Why you would come to such a poor city that you claim you love to ask them for this money? Just to put it in perspective, the TIF district encompasses six communities in South Baltimore. These are very poor communities, including Westport and Cherry Hill, which has some of the highest concentration of public housing in the country, like east of the Mississippi. They've not seen development in that community in more than 40 years. Huge unemployment rates, huge incarceration rates of returning citizens in this neighborhood. But it's also positioned on the other side of a river. Now, if you compare that with probably 300 yards away is another community that could have been drawn into the TIF, which is a very high-end community. They are just building high-end condos, almost adjacent to the Port Covington property. The biggest thing about the way this funding will work is it will have a devastating impact on public school funding in the city of Baltimore. And the vast majority of students in Baltimore City public schools qualify for free and reduced lunch. And if this TIF is given, on the low end, the estimate is $300 million in cuts to education funding. On the high end, it's $1.6 billion in cuts to education funding, all because the way the school gets funded by the state is that it's based on the wealth of the district. So this development brings an enormous amount of wealth to the district, but none of that, meaning the value of the property will go up significantly, but as you mentioned, the tax dollars that would normally go to the school system because of the increase in the value of that property instead goes to pay back the loan.
Well, that's an unbelievable probably bait and switch. If it was to pass, that people would find out. Now, the other issue that's a big issue is Who are going to be the people who work in the construction jobs, and who and how much are they going to get paid? It looks like the developer is trying to trying to get out of having a project labor agreement, which would require that it be union labor. But one of the issues I wanted to touch on is now I think it's the Maryland Washington Minority Contractors Association. What they say about this project labor agreement issue is, well, unions don't even hire a lot of black people in the community, or have a lot of black people's members, rather, in the communities in Baltimore that need the most help. So if there's a project labor agreement, they won't be able to actually hire people from these poor communities and perhaps make them less poor, and anything else will just keep them out. So I wonder how you react to that argument as well.
Well, I don't believe that that is actually true. We have unions here in Baltimore City that have that hire directly from the community. And the great thing about a project labor agreement is that that's something that you could spell out in the agreement, that you're requiring people from the community to be hired, and it's enforceable. One of the things we're working on, and we're working in coalition with 30 other organizations out there, is for a citywide community benefits agreement that would include a good jobs guarantee, so that, and would include apprenticeship training and pre-apprenticeship training. So we could get people who are unemployed now, get them into a pre-apprenticeship program, get them into a five-year apprenticeship program. This is a 40-year build. So people would be able to get out of high school, get into an apprenticeship, and actually finish, retire from the build of this project. If it's done right and with a community benefits agreement, we could have Baltimore City people employed on this, just on the in the construction jobs for 40 years. The other thing we're asking for is a good jobs guarantee for the retail and service sector jobs, and 51% of hires for those jobs as well as the construction jobs. 51% of Baltimore City residents hired in the to work in the Port Covington development. We are committed that our city council should not approve this financing or any public dollars for this project until we get that those kind of guarantees in a citywide agreement.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's 100%, you know, makes a lot of sense. And I wonder, just in general, I mean, what do you want to see? I mean, do you feel like the city council in Baltimore needs to also put in place more just sort of general accountability laws, clawback laws, and things like this? Because I think in every city USA, we know that people promise X and deliver Y, and it's never as much as what they say. I mean, beyond the particular things in this agreement, do you also think, just as a backstop, this is a sign that people need to look more at sort of putting in these sort of general types of accountability mechanisms for projects that are receiving public money?
Absolutely. You know, that is our number one demand of the city council, is that there is a public process that people can, there's more transparency so that people can see what the numbers are, and that they do their own financial analysis. We cannot continue to give away public money like it's candy and like it's free without doing our due diligence and making sure that the numbers work for the city, not just take the developer's word for it. So we have in our demands for the city council have outlined a number of financial responsibility measures we'd like them to take, which include an independent financial analysis, an independent market study, look at how it will impact school funding, how it will impact transportation funding for the future, and if there are opportunity costs. This council has previously done a report of tax subsidies and TIFs in the past and come forth with recommendations for how to fix this, the process, and they've not implemented one of them, nor have they actually looked at this deal and said, hey, let's stop and take some of our own advice or look at some of the mistakes we've made in the past and make sure that we're not making them with this deal. And to be fair, you know, Kevin Plank and his company, Sagamore, they are using, you know, every political connection, every, you know, notoriety they're using, their notoriety as Under Armour, and to try to force this through before people, before the people have had a chance to weigh in and before we've done any kind of thorough financial analysis.
Excellent. And well, thank you so much. We're going to leave it there today. And that is going to be it for today's show. You were listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. Special thanks to all our guests, including Charlie Carter, who you just heard. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. And as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. See you next time.
By any means necessary.